And good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Dr. Carsonia Wise Whitehead has been on our show many, many times, and I'm glad to welcome her back this morning. She's Assistant Professor of Communication and African-American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland. Last time she was here, we talked about her award-winning book, Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, which she published last year. In her new book, Kay Whitehead has collected letters and poems she has written to her two sons, Kofi and Amir. In the wake of the shootings of African-American men and boys in Ferguson, Cleveland, Staten Island, and elsewhere, the book couldn't be more timely or more poignant. It's called Letters to My Black Sons, Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America. Kay, it's nice to see you.
Thank you so much for inviting me back.
And on this very, very cold 5-degree morning, we get to talk about a very warm and just, you know, heartwarming book. Let's talk first about the title. The subtitle says Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America. And after post-racial, there's a big red question mark. We are, of course, not yet in a post-racial world, are we?
No, we're not. And that's the idea behind putting post-racial. First, we have a yellow post-it mark over the word post, and then racial with the question mark, because we sometimes hear that we're in a post-racial America because of the election of President Barack Obama. But the way that things are playing out in the streets and the way that African-American boys are moving through society and the ways that they are being examined and the way they're being probed and the way they're being marked shows us and tells us and proves to us that we are not yet post-racial, nor are we post-racist in so many ways.
Yeah. We want equality, of course. We want equal opportunity. We want people to be treated with equal dignity. But do we want even a post-racial world? I mean, if we think about utopia, if we think about, you know, the ideal, you know, on the same hand, we have this term celebrating diversity, which is, right, of course, something worthy of lifting up. So what's the balance? What does post-racial mean, and what's the ideal that we're looking for?
I think that's something that we struggle with individually and then collectively as a nation. What does it mean to be post-racial? Does post-racial mean that we erase your identity, we erase your ethnicity, we erase your culture, or do we get to a point where you're being judged for who you are, not for what you look like? It's kind of that old King speech, right? Being judged by the content of your character. And part of who I am and as I move through here is this experience of being a Black woman in America. That is important to me. That defines me. That marks me. I don't want to move past that. I don't want to be erased in a sense. I want my voice to matter, but I want to be included at the table. And so when I think about a post-racial America, and I tie into that a post-racist America, but getting to a place when we can look beyond these differences, because difference does not mean deficit. It just means difference, and that all voices are included and people have an opportunity to really succeed and to be seen and judged based upon what they can do, not based upon all the history that surrounds them. Now, can we ever get there? I don't know. You use the word utopia, and utopia unfortunately means so many different things to everyone. I think that's part of the thing that makes America so great. We have this very tense fabric, and we all add our piece of what we think the American dream should be. That's why we're so wonderful. So we may never be post-racial. And in so many ways, I think that's okay.
Yeah.
I think it's this place where we struggle. It's the place where all of our identities kind of combine. That's what makes it interesting. And that's what we kind of strive to be in that space. So what does post-racial mean? Should we even get there? Or is it the struggle to get there that's interesting?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Before you taught at Loyola, you made movies, you did documentary films, and now you've been teaching at Loyola for how long?
I've been there for 6 years.
Yeah.
Prior to coming to Loyola, actually, I was a middle school teacher, mm-hmm, here in Baltimore for 4 years. And then prior to that, I was in New York as a documentary filmmaker with MTV and a PBS affiliate for almost 15 years. So
yeah,
I'm on my third career here.
Yeah, yeah. And in this career, you've been teaching African and African-American studies. You've taught courses on Ferguson. You've done teach-ins on,
yes,
you know, the situations in Ferguson and Staten Island. Here we have this young kid, Tamir Rice, 12 years old in Cleveland, gunned down by a police officer there. One of the sons to whom you've written a letter is your own son, Amir.
Right. That one was particularly
difficult.
Also 12
years old. That must have been heart-wrenching in so many ways.
It was difficult for me because Amir pointed it out. He said, oh, his name is Tamir, and my name is Amir. Mommy, he's 12, and I'm 12. I could be Tamir. I'm like, no, baby. You cannot. I said, my job as your mother, as your protector, as your provider, along with your father, is we're trying to cover you. And we want to put you in the places where we can keep you safe. Can we keep you safe every single day and every single minute? No, we can't. But we can do the best that we can to make sure you're home at night and not in the streets, to make sure that you have certain toys that you're playing with and you're making good choices. Because unfortunately, the way our society is put together, how can I stop you from being Tamir? In so many ways, I cannot. The best that I can do is try to raise you well, try to instill values in you, to get you to believe in something other than yourself, and then to send you out and pray my head off. Because at the end of the day, that's really all I have.
The talk that you talk about in the book, that you and so many other Black parents have had to have with their young sons in particular, you realized after the Zimmerman verdict in the Trayvon Martin case, when George Zimmerman was acquitted of any wrongdoing in that murder of Trayvon Martin, that is such a difficult conversation to have. How did you approach that with your two sons? And Amir, as you say, is 12. His older brother, Kofi, is 14.
Yes, that was a very interesting moment in our household. Because when you think about the talk, and I think, of course, with quotations around the word talk, you think about parents telling their children about making good sexual choices, being clear about who you're going to date and how you're going to live your life. Well, in our house, after what happened to Trayvon Martin, my husband and I sat down and realized that we needed to have the race talk with our sons. We talk about race a lot in our household. We had not talked about the ways that your race could define and mark you. I mean, they know about the civil rights movement. They've seen the documentaries. They've heard the stories. But the Trayvon Martin incident reminded us that perhaps we were not doing enough to prepare them for the type of world they need to be able to negotiate in, to navigate themselves through. And so that's the first and only time that my husband and I actually co-wrote an op-ed together, where we talked about we could be Trayvon Martin's parents. And that op-ed started off as a letter to Kofi, saying we need to talk about protecting you. Even though Maryland does not have a stand your ground law, there are these unofficial and unwritten stand your ground laws at the playground. So even there, it's not always about police officers coming into the community. There are people around you who look like you, who can actually do harm to you. So how do you make the best choices? How do you go right when everybody else is going left? Because going right might ultimately save your life.
You talk about how you and your husband discussed how you thought you could achieve your way out of having the talk because, you know, you're professionally successful. The kids are well cared for. They live in a comfortable environment. They have many advantages that lots of kids, white and black, don't have. But you can't achieve your way out of the kind of dangers that are just sort of implicit with being adolescent in general, but very specific to young African-American boys.
I think that's part of the Black American dream. We think that if we move to a certain neighborhood, we put our sons, for us in particular, put our sons into independent schools. They're playing baseball for the state and they're traveling around the country. They're going different places from the White House to the March on Washington, that they will be safe, that the things that affect boys that are in other communities will not affect them. That is an absolute mistake. Because when what happened to Trayvon Martin, it didn't matter whether he was on his way to college. It didn't matter whether he could read or write. It didn't matter whether he had a job. It was the color of his skin that marked him. And in so many ways, when you look at Tamir Rice and the fact that the police officer thought this 12-year-old boy was a 20-year-old man and that he was a monster and all the things that played out in that 1.6-second video that you see, it doesn't matter. If your child lives in a certain community, it doesn't matter how hard you've worked. It doesn't matter if they know right from wrong. It's the color of their skin and their gender that defines them in that quick split moment when decisions are made. And that's what the talk was about. It's that we can only do what we can to protect you. And then ultimately, our hope is that you'll be able to live out this future and everything we poured in you to make you a better person, to make my two sons into better men, and to make them into armor bearers, that ultimately that will work itself out.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, Kay Wise Whitehead. Her new book is called Letters to My Black Sons, Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America. Nikki Giovanni, who has been on the show before and is just such a wonderful presence, you quote her in the book, and she says, childhood remembrances are always a drag if you're black. Are they going to be a drag for Kofi and Amir? What do you think?
That poem Nikki wrote is one of my favorite ones. That, you know, at the end of the poem, she says, you know, when they tell your story, that they will not realize, and I'm just doing a horrible paraphrasing of it, but they won't realize that in the midst of you being poor and Black, you were happy, that these childhood remembrances are ultimately your childhood memories. When I decided to publish Letters to My Black Sons, I asked my sons for permission, and they gave me permission, but I say not really, because they're 12 and 14, and how can they really say, Mama, you can't publish the letters you've been writing to us? I wonder about that day, and I write about it in the book, the day when they come to me and they really have questions about my decision to expose their life, my decision to document every single thing that's happened to them and then to share it with the world. My hope is that when I have to answer that question, as I know I will, all parents have to answer the question of why did you do these things to me, that I hope I can tell them what my father told me when I asked him the same questions. Why did you raise me the way that you raised me? And he said, I did the best that I could at the time with the information that I had. And if I had to do it all over again, I'd probably do it the same way because I'd be the same person. And so if I had to do it all over again and start over with these two young Black boys in my arms like I did, you know, 14 years ago, I'd probably do it the same way. Documenting their life is a way of healing for me. And I often tell them, if you forget how much I love you, if something happens to me and you're without me and you wonder, like, what was Mommy here for? And why was she a part of my life? Pick up my letters. Pick up any of the 30 plus journals where I talk about every day of your life and just be reminded of how important, how special you are. And even if the world doesn't see it, I see it. Yeah. I believe in you. I see you.
Yeah. And I think every mother, every father listening can identify with that and say a big amen to that. Of course, you talk a lot about yourself in this book. I mean, this is in a way about a sort of personal memoir because you talk about how you were raised. You talk about your mom, your dad, your grandparents, your mother-in-law and her battle with cancer. I mean, you talk a lot about personal things that, you know, that the children, you know, weren't involved with directly. So this becomes a history of your family for them and for the rest of us to enjoy.
I think that's why my parents definitely enjoyed the book. There's a story in there about my parents meeting for the first time. I think my mom was 13 and my father was 16. And the time that they kind of got to know each other with my father in a white suit that got smaller every year because he wore it every single year, that it does document our family. That there's this space where I want to write about my sons, and I use my own life as a lens to do that. The book is very healing for me, that there are times when I'm down, times when I feel like I'm trying to keep all these balls in the air, and I know so many people can understand what I'm talking about, of being a mother, of being a wife, of working, of being an activist, of being aware, of being attuned to myself, and I'm doing 1,000 things, and none of them are doing anything very well at that time. And I remind myself that all I can do is work as hard as I can. All I can do is pour everything I have into my sons because I don't have a do-over. That you have one opportunity with these boys and it's going so quickly. I mean, they're 14 and 12 and I remember 3 and 5, which is what the picture is on the cover of the book. I remember when they were in my arms. I remember when they were learning how to walk. And just like all parents around the world, we remember how quickly they grew from being all ours to being themselves.
Yeah.
And in that short amount of time, we just have to do all that we can to get them ready and to get them prepared to make good, solid choices and to think about what it means to be happy.
You talk about, and we have talked about on this program any number of times previous, about how it's important that as a society, we have a serious conversation about race. That conversation has been going on in one way or another, certainly since, you know, President Obama was elected in 2008 and in many ways, certainly before that. But how has that conversation changed now in a second term of Obama and with, you know, the shootings last summer and the heightened awareness and the heightened activism and literally on the street protests about what's gone on in places like Ferguson and Staten Island and Cleveland? How is that conversation changing? And is it, in your view, changing for the better?
I do think it's changing for the better. Looking just at the administration for just a moment, one of the big things that happened for President Obama in his second term is he began hosting his Black History Month panels. Prior to that, he did not have any in his first term. So he's had 3. And every year, the White House has worked with the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, Carter G. Woodson's organization, to bring Black scholars together to talk about what's happening in Black America. I've been selected the last 3 panels, and this year I decided that I wanted to do a series for the Baltimore Sun that examined and explored the state of Black America. Because I called in one of my op-eds after what happened with the Dunn trial, I called for a conversation about race. Not just coming from the White House, but coming from every single center where there are people that are gathered around this country. We have to talk about this elephant. We have to talk about this beast that continues to rage us through our community. We have to deal with it. And there have been ways that we have tried to do that. I think that now one of the biggest things we can do is have more conversation and be honest and be open and be willing to have the difficult conversations, because we're all a part of this American system. I think these conversations are happening. I think they're happening for the good and the better of all of us. I think they're difficult, and I think we have a lot of work to do. But from the White House down to the inner cities, if we're all focused on trying to be better as a community, I think that we can get there. Now, this might sound like a Pollyanna perspective, that if we just talk about race, then eventually we'll be fine with it. I don't think it's just that. I think talking about it is the first step to confronting it, and then once you can confront it, then you can begin to accept it, and then you can begin to ultimately see beyond it.
Dr. Carsonia Wise Whitehead from the Department of Communication at Loyola University, Maryland, where she also teaches African and African American studies. Her new book is called Letters to My Black Sons, Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America. It's published by Prentice House Press. Dr. Whitehead will be speaking about her book Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Loyola Notre Dame Library, where an exhibition of her letters will be on display. We've got a link to more information about the book and that appearance on our website. Come on over to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. Kay Whitehead, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.